Oh, You're in the Right Place is number 360, a review of Lester Bush's Health and Medicine Among the Latter-day Saints. There is no panel chairman designated, and so I presume I am he. And this is it. Has anybody in the room other than the panelists read this book? Oh, my goodness. Well, this may change the tone of the meeting entirely in that case. Thinking that nobody here would have read it, I thought that for my part I would just give you a review instead of a critique, because there's no point in critiquing what you haven't read. How the others are going to approach that, I'm not sure. But I would like to introduce to you others to be announced. They are at the front table, all of them physicians. Cindy Bateman has been my good friend for the last 2 minutes, and Cindy is a physician who grew up in Provo. She went to BYU and then took a giant step across the country to Johns Hopkins, one of the finest medical institutions in the country, to do her medical training. She has done her specialty training in internal medicine, and she now practices back here in Salt Lake with a group of, I think, three other women. Five. So there truly is a women's medical clinic that deals with general medicine in Salt Lake. And I meant to say that. And Cindy tells me that she likes to spend her spare time doing humanitarian things and has participated in most of the humanitarian things that Lester Bush mentions in his chapter on caring, which is the section of this book that she's going to present. Clyde Ford is also a graduate or a Utah native, a graduate of the University of Utah Medical School, one of the top two in his class, and then also went back east to a prestigious institution, to Duke, where he did his internal medicine training and then specialty training in hematology and oncology. And he is the father of hematology and oncology. That's the study of blood and cancerous diseases. We'll let that comment pass. And I remember I first got interested in Clyde's interest in things when I sat down to have a discussion with him once, and we started talking about oncogenes, and pretty soon had evolved to the discussion of the religion of Laman and Lemuel. And I don't know of the tie there, but he perhaps will tell you. Clyde is an interesting person. He attends Bible seminars of various sorts all around the country. He's also the father of six, one of whom has a fractured scapula and clavicle this morning. And he doesn't do bone transplants. He does bone marrow transplants, so he can be of no help to his son. Hal Cole, the other panelist in front, grew up in California, is a graduate of Stanford University Medical School, and came to the University of Utah for his training in internal medicine and gastroenterology. Hal was my resident when I was a junior medical student and first doing clinical training. And I became immediately interested in Hal as my kind of internist as we were making rounds on the ward the very first day. And had entered the room of a fairly pitifully ill, young, recently married woman who was having all kinds of GI complaints. And Hal didn't mention any of the GI complaints at all. What he said is, this woman needs a spousectomy. And I figured this was a person who really understood medicine as it should be understood. He also introduced me to my wife, who is the sister of his wife. So we go back a long way. Hal is the father of seven. He is a politician in medicine. He has served as the president of the Utah Medical Association and is currently in the Utah delegation to the American Medical Association. He has also for many years headed the State Medical Association's Ethics Committee. Hal is going to address a chapter on death and dying. and also on morality and dignity and whatever else comes to mind. Clyde is going to address the chapters on being well and suffering and on healing. And what remains for me is the chapter on madness. I'm a psychiatrist practicing in Salt Lake. We're going to hear from Hal first. But before that, by way of just a brief introduction, since we're all physicians and since we are all aware of Joseph Smith's opinion of physicians, in fact, we just came from a seminar, some of us, where we had heard that the Book of Mormon was an autobiography of Joseph Smith's life, focusing on the Sword of Laban, which was his attempt to symbolically control and do away with the surgeon who had operated on his leg at 14. My response to that was that since it was a psychiatrist presenting the paper, I thought his reason for writing the paper focusing on the Sword of Laban was counterphobic. This was his response to not having gone into surgery and psychiatry instead when he was in medical school. A man died and went to heaven, and he got there after hours. When he got there, the gate was locked, and he couldn't get in, and this was a very distressing thing for him because he had been trying to lead a righteous life, and now the final moment was here when his reward was due, and he got there, and the gates were locked. And he didn't know what to do, but he pounded on the gates, and he pounded, and nothing happened, and he pounded, and he called out, and pretty soon somebody came to the gate, and it turned out to be Peter. And he said, please, can I get in? And Peter said, well, can't you see we're closed? Well, the man said, I can see that, but, you know, this is very distressing to me because I have worked all my life for this moment, and I really hope you can let me in. Peter said, no, there are no exceptions. We can't open the door for anyone after hours. And the man was just chagrined, and he said, there must be some mistake. I know I have led a kind of life that would warrant my coming here. Can't you please go check somewhere? And Peter said, all right. And he went and cranked up the computer, and he turned up a few screens, and he scanned it a little bit, and pretty soon he said, oh, yes, there you are. Your name is right there. But wait a minute. You're not due to be here for 8 more years. What was the name of your doctor? We're going to hear from a doctor named Hal.
Good afternoon. I think it's perfectly delightful that we have a small group. If it were up to me, we would put all the chairs in a big double circle and hold hands and talk about this. I think that Lester Bush's book is carefully crafted and well-researched and quite academic, especially on the historical aspects. But the subject he's talking about is a lot warmer than the book itself is. And if his wife is here, I apologize. I hope he's warmer with her. But to give you an example of what he could have said in the book, and is welcome to put in the second edition, I think it'd be great, are first in the area of ethics. In the mid-1970s, when I first got involved with medical ethics in the state of Utah, it was forbidden by the AMA for a physician to associate with what were termed unscientific healers. Now, the chiropractors successfully went to court over this because they said that's crazy, and they indeed won, and the AMA changed their ethics. But it struck me as so remarkable that here I am part of a church in which I wear two hats. One hat as the pure scientist who quotes patients and applies the scientific literature to the individual in front of me, and the second as a genuine, non-scientific, or we might say supra-scientific practitioner. Okay? And this came to me the first year I was in Utah, because I would end up with these LDS patients. And I was working over at the Salt Lake VA on Ward 2B, which you will all perhaps remember, in the dark little room there. And I put in the hospital a gentleman who was a sheriff from Delta or one of the towns in that area. And this sheriff was sent up to us because they could not quite figure out what was wrong with him. He had not as many red blood cells as he should have, and he had not as many white blood cells as he should have. And they were a little bit funny. They looked a little bit odd. And when I went over him, he had sternal tenderness, meaning I would push on here, and it hurt. And to my mind, in 1970, the first diagnosis that came to mind was that he either had leukemia, pre-leukemia, or myeloma. And so as I finished my workup, I wrote this all down, I laid out the plan for this guy, I felt bad. And then his son came to that little room at 2B and said, "Hey, could you help me give a blessing to Dad?" I said, "Okay," presuming that he, being the son, would do the sealing part. And so we went, and he did not. He grabbed the oil, which, in, as you know, means he's going to do the anointing. And so he anoints his dad. Says, "Go to it." Okay, now I'm fresh from California. You know, I have not been on a mission. I have not been a part of this thing. I have only done maybe 4 blessings in my life. And I'm about to do this thing to this person. In our belief, I am to take the place of Jesus Christ and bless this guy. And I'm also expected to prognosticate. Enough bad things that happened to me that day. I put my hands on his head. And what you do when you do this is you place your conscious, rational mind about 3 feet over there, and you open your consciousness, and you start talking. And it is very much like playing hotter, colder, where everybody, you know, when you're getting warm, everybody yells warmer, warmer, hotter, hotter. And you start to speak, and you can tell whether it's hotter or colder, and you go your way. And I had an absolutely different feeling about the sheriff. And I blessed the guy that he would get better, and that we would find out what was wrong with him, and everything would be fine in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. And I went back to my little room and thought, oh. But in fact, what happened there was that there are simply 2 parts to the 2 persons, one part of which is intellectual and scientific, and one part of which is emotional and religious and super rational. I'd been trained in all this stuff to focus on one and leave the other one alone. And I think that Brother Bush, in his book, could really make some mileage out of the experience of letting your rational mind go and speaking what the Spirit tells you to speak. Because there really is not anything quite like that among our Catholic brethren, at least because the priest is giving the anointing. And I know it isn't among our Presbyterian brethren. So there is a little more magic here that could have come into this text as he might have explained about, first, the ethical problem of the Mormon physician who is, in fact, wearing 2 hats, who can switch from rational to super-rational, you know, with the flick of a tie or a bottle of oil or whatever it is. And then secondly, the whole idea that when we give a blessing, which to my mind has 3 parts, one of them is validation of the person. And this is written down nowhere. This is part of the marvel of this thing. This is written down nowhere. I have no idea. I never went on a mission. I'm going to ask the missionaries in the group, and I don't know. Lou went. I get he did. Who taught you how to do this? How do people learn to do this? Because it is quite amazing to put your hands on somebody's head and validate them, which means tell them God thinks they're all right, and secondly, prognosticate their illness, which they certainly expect, whether we do it or not, and then thirdly, predict an outcome. Well, invoke the powers of heaven on them and the physicians and a whole bunch of other people, apart from the prognosticating, to get God's will to be done. That's quite amazing. Okay, so we talked about ethics. We talked a little bit about giving blessings. One other part that I would like to emphasize, he is very careful not to tell Mormon cultural stories. He does tell one about a farmer turning up a grave and the skeleton of a child gets all the skin and blood vessels and everything, comes back on and then disappears. And he uses this to emphasize the story of the bodily resurrection. But if he's going to allow himself to tell those stories, if he's going to enter that whole realm of things we believe that there's nothing really written down about, he ought to deal with, in the death and dying chapter, the belief of people coming to take people away. You know about that? Yeah. You think about Brigham Young on his deathbed. He does not speak to any of his wives or to Jesus Christ. He speaks to Joseph Smith. His last words are, "Joseph, Joseph. Joseph has come to take him away." I'm not sure, just as I'm not sure how people learn to do this, I'm not sure where that belief comes from that your relatives or your special kinspeople come at the time of your death to take your hand, presumably in some sort of a grip, and away you go. Where does that come from? What does that mean? I had a very fascinating experience with this once. Again, I wasn't there. I was the doctor. The patient was an old crusty film writer from Los Angeles who had grown up here and whose cousin was George Albert Smith and who was dying of cancer of the esophagus. Took him a year to die. At the end of the year, he said, "Doc, if I'd had to do it over again, you should have just given me a 45. I'm sorry, Brother Smith, I did the best I could." And so he went off to his cabin in southern Utah to die, accompanied by his son. And his son was the one who came back and told me this story and actually took the time to come to the office to tell me the story because it was sort of illustrative of what his dad was like, but also because he wanted me to know the story. And his father was in the last stages of his cancer. He was having trouble breathing, and it was early in the morning, and they were by a lovely river in southern Utah, which got a hot springs near it. He was sitting in a trailer across the river. And all of a sudden, he could tell, he could see in his father's face that somebody had come in the room. And there was more than one person because he'd looked back and forth. And this crusty old fellow would not go with him. Okay? Now, this, I'm sure whoever they were, they had not expected this. He said, "No, I won't go." And they went on for a period of approximately an hour arguing. He was not always coherent, but he was arguing with two or three people about the fact that he would not go with them, whether it was that he disliked them personally or whether it was that they were going to do something he didn't like. And after an hour, he finally said, "Okay," and dropped over in the bed dead. Now, it's because this is a Mormon family and his son is a Mormon that he interpreted this to be the relatives from the other side. I would not even speculate how he got along with his cousin, and it may have been his cousin for all I know. In a Catholic tradition, you know, you think of the last act of Don Giovanni. Who comes to get Don Giovanni? All these demons are singing. You know, you remember that in Mozart's version, the whole house is going in the basement and all the devils are singing. Well, for us, it's the family that comes to take this person away. In the same way, Brother Bush could have gotten some real miles out of the idea that, and as you correct me if I'm wrong, I didn't find this in the book, that the blessings are in fact given within the family. You do not have to have a recommend to give a blessing. You don't even have to be worthy to give a blessing. One of the most fun talks I remember from Brother Ashton, this is Brother Ashton of the Quorum of the Twelve, was when he was a young person and probably a bishop or an Elders Quorum president, he had someone in his group he was trying to reactivate, and he had a blessing to go give. And so he called up this really totally inactive brother and said, "Brother Peterson, we need to go give a blessing to Sister Jones," or whatever her name was. And Brother Peterson said, "Oh, Brother Ashton, I don't believe I'm worthy to do that. And Brother Ashton's response was, well, make yourself worthy in the next 45 minutes and I will come and pick you up. And we'll go do that. This is a wonderfully liberal part of our whole tradition. You can cross gender lines. Women can give blessings. You can cross ecclesiastical lines. I've given blessings to Catholic people. Maybe later I'll tell the story about one of them. And all the only question was, do you believe this will help? You can cross all those lines. You do not need a recommend. I teach the 16-year-olds, and in the Sunday school class that I teach, the lesson 3 weeks ago was about the importance of the church and getting authorization to do everything. And in there, they made a special point about the fact that Father's blessings, you don't have to talk to anybody. No one tells you what to say. There is no limit how long they go or how often they're given. It is a wonderfully liberating sort of experience. And the person within the family who is blessed by their father or their brother or their son, there is a warmth and unity there that I believe the priest cannot give who comes from the outside. The handing over of the generations one to another comes when the young person blesses his wife. And I recently saw this in a family whose name you would know if I said it. And this daughter had appendicitis and came to my office and went to the hospital to get her appendix out, and everybody, including the patriarch of the family, all huddled in the hospital room, and she was about to be wheeled off by one of our partners to go up the operating room. And in contrast to the usual practice, the son stepped forward and said, we're going to give her a blessing, and Dad, who's the powerful person you never say no to, you may anoint and I will seal. And this symbolized that the passage had taken place, that this son was now on his own, that he was going to take that role. And that whole flavor is really good and really important and really, really something that does not occur significantly in other faiths. The other thing I might say, I have about 2 minutes to my 15, which is very much along the same lines, is I once had the experience of blessing someone who 2 weeks later became my patient and was the most dreadful person. Almost, I was sued my partner when he was trying to fix her. It was just awful. But the experience of giving her a blessing 2 weeks before that was really quite extraordinary, in the sense that when you put your mind over here, and I was blessing her, someone who I did not know, and I did not know what a crumb she is in terms of a behavior, the sense of her as a troubled but loved human being was almost overwhelming. And you would be amazed how rarely you feel anything negative about the individual. You may have a definite sense that this is it, and you bless them that you know they're dead, they're gone. But the sense of love you feel doing this is quite amazing. To one of the crummiest people I have ever met in my entire life, that was an important experience, you know, to me. Well, my time is gone. I've suggested a few things, and I think we'll be able to have a vigorous discussion about some other aspects of Brother Bush's book. But I think he's done just an excellent job, and maybe he was counseled by his editors not to put in that sort of stuff. That's possible. But I think there's a lot in this whole healing area that is warm and liberating, and that could be communicated to our fellow believers of different faiths.
When Dr. Bench asked me to do this, my first response to him was that I felt somewhat inadequate. But, you know, shrinks have a way of manipulating people, and they're professionally trained to do that. And I have always found it difficult to say no to them. Dr. Cole, I enjoyed your talk immensely, except for one thing, and that is that all the discussion about blessings and physicians and their conflicts are in my chapters. So we'll throw away the second half here. I'm not against speaking extemporaneously, but there's a tremendous amount of material in my chapters, and if I'm going to cover even a part of what I'd like to, I can't do it that way. So I apologize to you. It's boring listening to someone read a paper, but I ask you to bear with me. While preparing for this presentation, I was recalling that during my medical career, I have been associated with clinics which have treated whom I would consider to be the three most prominent church leaders of the last two decades. Interestingly, two of these, the three treating physicians, were not members of the church. I have no doubt that in addition, each of these church leaders had undergone administrations by carefully selected, spiritually qualified priesthood holders. In February of 1831, the Prophet Joseph received the following oft-quoted revelation regarding illness. Quote, "And whosoever among you are sick shall be nourished with all tenderness with herbs and mild food, and the elders of the church, two or more, shall be called and shall pray for and lay their hands upon them in my name." See, that passage is in my chapter. Okay, these passages and the actions of current leaders suggest that both modern and early Latter-day Saints distinguished between two major approaches to disease. The first, which we might call medical care, represents knowledge which is theoretically easily shared and duplicated. The second, exemplified by laying on of hands in the presence of the Spirit, is a deeply personal, subjective experience, as Dr. Cole has pointed out to us, not easily described, especially to outsiders. Occasionally, a practice may have combined ritual and therapeutic approaches. For example, 19th century anointings, which we no longer practice in this day and age. These were exceptions. In two chapters of his book, Health and Medicine Among the Latter-day Saints, Dr. Lester Bush, Jr. traces the use of the therapeutics of secular medicine and religious LDS ritual through a century and a half of church history. This is an enormous and ambitious undertaking. While I may disagree with some of his conclusions, I will recognize that Dr. Bush is a scholar in this field and has obviously spent a great deal of time in researching and organizing what I would consider to be an extremely interesting and enlightening book. And I think it's, although it's written probably for non-members of the church, there's a great deal of interesting information in it for members of the church who are interested in our history and some of the changes that have occurred. In my limited time, I propose to discuss some issues related to Dr. Bush's handling of the two most important Latter-day Saint scriptural passages which have been related to health, namely the scripture that I just quoted and the Word of Wisdom. Repeatedly, Dr. Bush implies or states his belief in these chapters that the revelations of Joseph Smith can best be understood as arising from the 19th century background and or the King James Bible. The Word of Wisdom was, quote, "to some degree a reflection of the times," end quote. While the scriptural passage I have quoted previously was supposedly produced by, quote, combining the therapeutic approach of James 5 and Mark 6 with the expected results of Matthew 11 and Luke 7. As an alternative to Dr. Bush's approach, I suggest that the revelations and statements of Joseph Smith, and to a great degree subsequent church leaders, actually have an internal consistency, which can be important and be an important key to interpretation. If one were to use this approach, one would attempt to interpret a passage in the context of contemporary 19th century authoritative utterances, especially the scriptural canon. I would like to illustrate the different conclusions which one might come to if one utilizes what we might call Dr. Bush's environmental approach versus the scriptural consistency approach. Let's consider the example of meat eating in the Word of Wisdom. By the way, do we have any of Dr. Bush's relatives here? No. Good. Okay. Here's what the Word of Wisdom says. And all of us, this will be familiar to all of us. Yea, flesh also of beasts and of the fowls of the air, I the Lord have ordained for the use of man with thanksgiving. Nevertheless, they are to be used sparingly. And it is pleasing unto me that they should not be used only in times of winter or of cold or famine. In interpreting this passage, Dr. Bush states, and I quote, and this is just about all of it in the book, although medical authorities often condemned what was perceived as excesses in meat consumption, they believed that some dietary meat was appropriate under certain circumstances. Generally speaking, a more stimulating diet, and I would underline stimulating was a big word in Joseph Smith's time among some groups, including meat, was useful when one was engaged in physically demanding work or when the body had to resist the cold of winter. A diet suitable under these circumstances could prove highly dangerous to a sedentary person, especially during warm months. Okay, do we all take that in? Dr. Bush's statement, which would have been well received by the followers of Sylvester Graham in his day, would tend to lead the reader to the following conclusions. Number one, the Word of Wisdom's prohibition on meat was to some degree influenced by then current medical opinion. Right? That's what he said. Number two, the Word of Wisdom teaches that excess meat eating is bad for one's health. Something we still hear occasionally today. And number three, meat eating during warm weather is especially bad for one's constitution. These conclusions, however, seem somewhat out of place in the context of the previous revelations and contemporary teachings of the prophet Joseph Smith. In a March 1831 revelation regarding meat-eating, and I quote, and whoso forbiddeth to abstain from meats is not ordained of God, for behold, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the air and that which cometh of the earth is ordained for the use of man for food and for raiment. And then the following caution. And woe be unto man that sheddeth blood, or that wasteth flesh, and hath no need. I suggest that these two Doctrine and Covenants meat-eating passages emanate from an identical worldview which must be discerned in order to understand their respective meanings. In other words, they are complementary passages, and each is likely to provide information for the interpretation of the other. The meaning of, quote, wasting flesh and having no need, I suggest is clarified by the Word of Wisdom admonition that the saints eat flesh only in times of cold or famine. In other words, the saints should not kill animals if grain and fruit, which are present during warm months, are available. Let us note the complete absence of health in this interpretation. In a 1970 paper, Gerald Jones quotes the Word of Wisdom meat-eating passage and proceeds to show that the doctrine of kindness to the animal kingdom was taught by early church leaders, including Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. who pointed out both the need of respect for God's creation and the possibility of hastening the millennium, an era when all animosity between man and animals themselves would cease. Joseph's kindness to animals' admonition, like much of the word of wisdom, did not appear to be universally adopted by church members, though it was by some. The following experience at Far West is related by Lorenzo Snow's biographer. Quote, "Up until now, it had never seemed to him," that is Lorenzo Snow, "that shooting turkey, squirrels, and other animal life was sinful. But at this time, a change came over him. Brother Snow attributed this change of attitude to the study of the gospel as restored through Joseph Smith. It must not be presumed, however, that he would condemn the killing of animals for food in times of scarcity." End quote. At the turn of the century, Roger Clausen recorded a sermon by Joseph F. Smith. This is in Roger Clausen's journal that has recently been published. In Brigham City, quote, "Did not believe in killing animals for the fun of the thing. It may be all right to kill for the purpose of appeasing hunger. Word of wisdom," end quote. Roger Clausen also noted elsewhere that the meeting provisions of the Word of Wisdom were, quote, "almost wholly disregarded," end quote, by the members of the church. I bring this up in case we have any deer hunters here anxiously awaiting the start of the season. Point is, there's two very different ways that we can interpret this passage depending on how we go about it. And Dr. Bush is kind of locks himself into one interpretation based not on the truth or falsity of that interpretation, but based on the assumptions that he starts out with. Now, if there are any here who still like the environmental approach, I have not really ruled that out with this alternate interpretation, because there were a number of groups practicing zoophilia in the United States in the 1830s. So you can, those of you who are still attached to that, don't have to give that up. Dr. Bush suggests that the leading medical knowledge of the early 19th century, as well as presumably the conventional wisdom among the populace, emphasized the negative health effects of alcohol, tobacco, and hot drinks. These views, he infers, had considerable influence on the formation of the Word of Wisdom. This conclusion, however, is difficult for me to accept for several reasons, most notably that from Kirtland to the latter 19th century, members and physicians alike within the church justified the use of the prohibited substances on the grounds that they were important medicinals, especially for restoring and sustaining physical and mental vigor. You find this all throughout the 19th century literature in the church. Church publications condemned excessive habitual non-medicinal use, especially of alcohol, and sometimes tobacco. In an article published in the Salt Lake Sanitarian, this is a journal that was published by physicians, LDS physicians here in the Valley. It was published for about 3 years and then went belly up for reasons I'm not sure of. The Salt Lake Sanitarian, available at the LDS Church office building. On the stacks, you don't even have to request it from the back. In an article in the Salt Lake Sanitarian, a late 19th century publication, an LDS physician admits, there's a very interesting article on tobacco by an LDS physician written about 1890. The physician admits to the therapeutic benefits of tobacco, but states that tobacco may induce disease in those habitually using it. While admitting its efficacy, the physician argues against the use of tobacco to, quote, "assist the intellectual operations," end quote. And I thought his reason for suggesting that people not use tobacco was very interesting. You know what it was? Quote, says Dr. Rush, "Tea and coffee are to be preferred when we wish to stimulate the mind." So, The suggestion above that the word of wisdom may actually be more concerned with placing the saints in harmony with God's creation rather than with physical health may also be applied to the question of the relation of the revelations and botanical medicine. And probably all of you know that there's been, you know, a number of articles written about this, most of which I believe are incorrect. As Dr. Bush has well pointed out in his book and previous papers, medical opinion was highly fragmented during the pioneer era. The pioneer era, you know, meaning early and mid and late mid 19th century. There were very few medical schools and only a handful of physicians involved in meaningful research. Community physicians, and this is very important, community physicians were most often not formally trained. They did not have a knowledge of basic science, and they could not understand even those advances that were made. Many physicians practiced so-called heroic medicine. We're going to talk about basically the three important facets of medicine that were practiced that might impact on the word of wisdom and that were related to by early church leaders. Heroic medicine was based upon the concepts of a very famous physician of the late 18th century named Benjamin Rush. And Benjamin Rush's idea, as I understand it, was that disease was caused by a buildup of poison in your body. And therefore, the treatment of disease involved the release and draining of this poison from your body. And he had some very ingenious ways to do it. He could bleed you and let it out that way. He could purge you with very strong purgatives, get it out that way, make you vomit and have diarrhea. He could blister you and, you know, draw fluid out or suction cut. You know, those were... he, in fact, had a tremendous influence on the medical profession for a number of decades after that. These were called the heroic physicians. However, most people, including Joseph Smith, could recognize that there was something wrong with this approach and that the therapy sometimes seemed to contribute to the demise of the patient as much or more than the disease. And so this resulted in the rise of a number of systems of what... areas where Dr. Cole would not be able to be associated with them under the 1970 guidelines. And there was one that was in fact particularly prominent and that in fact equaled at times or maybe even exceeded the number of patients going to Orthodox physicians. And this was what were known as Thompsonian physicians. And the Thompsonian physicians had a favorite herb. They were basically herb doctors. They had a favorite herb, and I want you to remember this name because it's going to come up again and again. Lobelia. Okay. Lobelia was a purgative, but it was a milder purgative than the major one used by the heroic physicians, which was calomel, which is not something I would want to take from what I've read about it. But there was a third. The predominant medical care among the frontier saints was neither heroic or organized botanical medicine. And I'd like to quote from a very interesting book called The Midwest Pioneer, His Ills, Cures, and Doctors by Picard and Bewley. Quote, much of the medical treatment in pioneer days was domestic and primitive. Provided a doctor were available, it required time and money to get his services, and he was, generally speaking, called only for serious cases. Even then, home remedies or folk cures were likely to have been used before the doctor was called. Besides being responsible for the domestic economy of the home, everything from food and clothing to spelling and courting, the mother, remember this, it's going to come up again, the mother, wife or woman of the house was by prerogative and default the custodian of medicines and administrator of treatments. If home resources did not suffice, there was usually someone in the community who was handy in caring for the sick and steeped in his or her lore and system of cures, a combination of homemade science, empiricism, and superstition. Now, many such remedies were considered to have been of Indian origin. Keep that in mind. And included commonly available materials, especially herbs. Thus, there existed among the early saints a core knowledge of home remedies, which was taught to daughters, shared among families, and occasionally published in church periodicals. You can find this occasionally, not very often. In my opinion, domestic medicine has not received the attention. Domestic medicine has not received the attention it deserves in regard to the interpretation of the herbal passages in the Doctrine and Covenants. I'm going to get into this just a little more. Much more time to go ahead. I may have to cut this short. An excellent description of pioneer domestic medicine practitioners is given in Carol Levitz's Doctors of the Old West. Quote, typical was 17-year-old Elizabeth Perry, who left Iowa for Oregon in 1845. With no doctor in the group, the teenager assumed the role, serving as midwife, collecting herbs and roots for medicinal brews, and generally ministering to the health needs of the caravan. End quote. This was the predominant pioneer medical care. In Dr. Bush's own example of Joseph Smith's malaria healings, Elijah Fordham is being treated when Joseph Smith comes in to give him a blessing with, quote, Indian meal poultices, end quote. Example in his book. In his journal, Josiah Stout, who had undoubtedly been treated for illness many times previously, records in Nauvoo how he reluctantly took his first dose of lobelia because he was very sick. Okay, so here this has been around for decades. Josiah Stout's taking his first dose in his journal when he is an adult, and he's resisting it even. Now, what had he been treated with all these years? Now, Linda Wilcox wrote an excellent article called The Imperfect Science, Brigham Young on Medical Doctors. And she described Brigham's criticisms of the organized full-time medical profession, and many of his criticisms, I think, can be shown to echo those of the Prophet Joseph Smith. From Brigham's negative comments, this is something she doesn't do in her article, but from Brigham's negative comments, we may derive Brigham's notion of the ideal deliverer of medical care as follows. Number one, they're not paid. Number two, they're not a full-time doctor. Okay, they're out doing other worthwhile things in addition. Number three, they do not use harmful remedies, such as calomel. And number four, they are probably a woman. Brigham Young called in a number of women, you'll recall, and sent them back east to be trained as physicians. You know, in response to the male non-LDS physicians coming into the valley. Now I ask you, who does this sound like? Who is he describing? I have often wondered, he's obviously describing the pioneer woman, you know, physician. That's the ideal. Now I have often wondered how Joseph and Brigham would have viewed me. A full-time, paid, male, cancer chemotherapist, often referred to by one of my colleagues as the poison doctor. Dr. Bush and others have suggested that the Section 42, the Doctrine and Covenants Section 42 phrase, quote, nourished with all tenderness with herbs and mild food, as well as the word of wisdom admonition, quote, and again, verily I say unto you, all wholesome herbs God hath ordained for the constitution, nature, and use of man, end quote, represents an endorsement for Thompsonian herbalism or similar practitioners. A major source of support for this conclusion rests on quotations from the prophet Joseph Smith, which I suggest do not actually lead one to Bush's conclusion at all. Joseph indeed did refer to Levi Richards, who was a close associate of his and a Thompsonian physician, as, quote, the best physician I have ever known, end quote. But if you read this passage carefully, the medical person that Joseph is actually praising is himself. And he is praising himself because he said, quote, I have never failed in administering comfort when the patient has thrown himself unreservedly on me. And the reason is that I never prescribe anything that would injure the patient, end quote. Levi Richards kept a journal, and he recorded in his own journal the prophet's criticism of a Dr. Brinks, who was an herbal physician. And the prophet again lauded his own record in terms of medical care and, quote, spoke of lobelia when the patient was too weak to bear it as being destructive, and said calomel would corrode the stomach, said it was a poison. Still said it was a medicine and useful only if used skillfully. From Joseph 1843 diary, quote, doctors in this region don't know much. Not much change, is there? It's this time. Doctors won't tell you where they go, where to go to get well. They want to kill or cure you to get your money. Calomel doctors will give you calomel to cure a sliver in your big toe. And calomel on an empty stomach will kill the patient. And the lobelia doctors will do the same. So does this sound like Joseph Smith was impressed with Thompsonian practitioners? So I'd ask you again, who was it that he was really impressed with? Okay, here's how he finishes this. If you feel any inconvenience, I will tell you what to do. You don't have to go to these guys. And he's talking about people who had just moved to Nauvoo who weren't used to the environment or were around the river and they got all kinds of illnesses. He said, take some mild physic two or three times and then some good bitters. Thus the prophet seemed to have negative feelings toward trained full-time physicians, both heroic and botanical, who, in the prophet's opinion, used calomel and lobelia incorrectly and excessively. It seems likely that the prophet's own medical advice is probably largely derived from frontier domestic medicine, because bitters, as an example, probably refers to a common home remedy used for general purposes and of varying favorite recipes. The Word of Wisdom's admonition to use herbs in season, and this is something that, to my knowledge, has never been emphasized. Am I wrong? To use herbs in season also suggests antagonism to organized herbalists, such as the Thompsonians and Shakers, who, for a fee, taught the preparation of or provided dried, preserved herbal medications. The Word of Wisdom's message seems to be to avoid such products because the Lord had provided herbal remedies which could be obtained without cost at any season from nature. I suggest that the Word of Wisdom's herbal passage, like the meat-eating one, seems to be more an admonition to live in harmony and utilize properly God's creation rather than an endorsement of organized herbalism. The consistent message of these verses seems to be that the outcome of living in harmony with nature and keeping the commandments was physical, mental, and spiritual vigor. However, while health reformers such as Sylvester Graham may not have had an important influence on the formation of the Word of Wisdom, and I have often wondered this, one does wonder about the possibility that health reform views may have been largely responsible for a subsequent association of the Word of Wisdom with physical health. I'm not sure anyone has addressed that in the past either. If that occurred, by the way, it probably occurred by the mid-1830s. Dr. Bush presents summaries on several other topics related to disease and healing. Some, such as the early saints' views on the cause of disease, have essentially no meaningful data to present, suggesting a lack of importance for this topic in the early church. The cause of disease was probably less relevant because immunity to disease and healing were primarily dependent on righteousness and faith. Didn't matter what the cause was, how you did with the disease. When what? Well, the initial revelation was section 42, and I'm not sure about before that. A number of other discussions, however, such as a description of 19th century Latter-day Saint healing rituals, many of which have been discarded in the 20th century, are very informative and highly recommended. Maybe I should end. I'm past my time. Let me just mention one more thing. When I I had an interesting recent conversation with a friend who was telling me all about the great benefits that he had derived from Zen Buddhism. And, you know, I had a couple of reactions to this. My first one was that Zen didn't exactly fit in with my belief system, and I wasn't particularly interested in seriously pursuing it. But the second one was that I recognized that although I had read a little bit about Zen, you know, in the past because of an interest, that I could never really understand what my friend was experiencing unless I got into it in a serious, believing, insider kind of way. And I think that Dr. Bush is undoubtedly very qualified to talk about lobelia and penicillin. But he takes a somewhat cool attitude, it seems to me, towards church leaders and church rituals. And also he discusses temple rituals in a way that I would suspect many members would find in poor taste. And so while he's well qualified to talk about lobelia and penicillin, I was wondering as I read him how brothers Brigham and Joseph, whether they would consider him among the group who had faith to heal and faith to be healed. Well, I'd like to thank Sunstone for this opportunity. I'd like to thank you all for enduring with a group of very professional physicians, but very amateur historians. Thank you.
Hope I can see over the podium. It's kind of noisy in that other room. So if you can't hear, tell me to speak up or move over like some people have done. I was asked to do this by Mary Beth Rains, who was supposed to do this. And she said, well, I'm pretty sure it's the ones you're supposed to do are chapters 7 and 8. And I said, oh, you're kidding. You know, chapter 6 is on sexuality and birth. Don't you think that's the one they would have asked you to do? And she said, well, I thought so too. But no, that's not what they told me. And so I prepare those chapters, and she has a problem with a disc in her back, so she can't sit for a long time. When I got here, I found out that was the chapter, but I'm not going to wing it on that thing called, she co-authored a book called Peculiar People that deals with some aspects of sexuality. I want to talk about chapter 7, and it's called On Caring. If you haven't read the book yet, you'll find out when you read it that this book is meaty. This is not a sit down, read through it, easy reading book. That's what Mary Beth told me when she gave it to me. Oh, it'll just take you a few minutes to prepare. This is a book that covers a lot of territory, and even just talking to you about one chapter is difficult to do in a short period of time. But I like this chapter because this is something that I have an interest in and I'm familiar with. So I'm going to take a few minutes and review a little bit what he's covers in the chapter and then tell you maybe a little critique about what I think this kind of a chapter, how it appeals to us, how it appeals to, I should say, to people of LDS background, and also how it would appeal to people who are not of LDS background, who I think are the primary readers of this book. This book was published by in a series on health and medicine that cover many different religious backgrounds, and this is representing the LDS tradition. So it's interesting to look at it as though you were completely outside, trying to understand what wacky things Mormons do. And the first thing he discusses, this is basically a compilation of a lot of things that didn't fit other medical topics. He starts out talking about how in the early days of the Mormon Church, they were very isolated, geographically, politically, in spiritually, economically. And because of that, they became very, very community-oriented. And many of the things we know about the church are related to that. He explains to the readers a little bit about the ward, how the ward functions, and how the ward comes together for the benefit of an ill person or someone who's having difficulty, sometimes in the form of fasting, sometimes in the form of group prayer. And like has been discussed, I was a little disappointed in that he doesn't spend more time on detail. It's a little bit philosophical, and for those of us who know the inside, it's a little dry just to sort of comment superficially about how these things are done. Anyone who's been involved in a group fast or a group prayer, he also mentions the prayer circle in the temple, and historically, you know the power of that kind of an endeavor. It's a little bit difficult to skim over and pass on the message. He also talks about a little more temporal nature, how the bishop functions in the ward to divide fast offering funds, help the poor, a little bit about what tithing funds are all about. And then he talks about home teachers and visiting teachers, and we all know a little bit about how that works. He doesn't editorialize much about how that works, and I think personally that this system was very effective in a time when the church was isolated. I think it's also still very effective in the mission field. I have questions about how effective it is in Zion, in a place where we all live in two square blocks. And, you know, the kids fall over each other all day in 12 activities at school, and I don't know, and that's another subject. He doesn't go into any of that either. But this is for the outsider to learn a little bit about how Mormons function and take care of each other. He then goes on to talk a little bit about more central ways of delivering caring, and starts with talking about the early origins of the Relief Society. And it really was the women in the church who first started to organize to provide for people in other than a spiritual way. When it came to health education, training nurses, child welfare, initiatives for the mentally handicapped, dealing with unwed mothers. There came a time I think it was more than 50 or 60 years that the Relief Society dealt with those, often with their own budget in the early days. And gradually those things came under the Welfare Services Program, which was begun in 1936. The welfare program evolved during the Depression. And it then took over most of the central or general temporal affairs. And they left to the Relief Society more local service in the wards. Hospitals were started initially by the Relief Society, and as many of you may know, the church system of hospitals grew dramatically during a period of time, and it wasn't until 1974 that the church divested itself of the hospital system. They had a strong devotion to providing good medical care for everyone who needed it. And at one point at their peak, they felt like more than half of the members of the church had access to what were considered good LDS hospitals. There was an operating network of 15 hospitals, 2,000 inpatient beds, backed by over 1,000 physicians, over 100,000 inpatients a year, and estimated 360,000 outpatient and emergency cases. So on a huge scale. But I think about in 1970, the Health Services Corporation was formed with James O. Mason at the head. And shortly after that, there came a vision of the church being an international church and a sense that why should the most elite, the most wealthy, the most educated members of the church have the benefit of all that concentrated hospital care when a growing number of people in the church didn't have access to such care. And they really changed their approach and tried to put some of that money. It was going to get very more and more expensive to deal with, more and more complicated. And that's the time at which they divested themselves. And from that time on, they shifted to a reliance on fast offerings. And you may know that fast offerings go completely to the needy and aid, temporal aid of the people in the ward first. So that was a big shift. He then goes on to talk about health missionaries and humanitarian service. This is the section that was interesting to me. In 1971, shortly after James Mason became director of the health services, I don't know if it was the Corps or corporation, what it was, health services corps, I guess, probably not a corporation, the first medical missionaries went out in an effort to go out and try to help in needy areas. But we're talking a nurse here, a doctor or two here, a dentist or two here on a very small scale. And in general, the church was unhappy with the outcome. I'm sure those missionaries worked very, very hard. But it's really hard to keep a specialist or someone who's trained from delivering acute care. They wanted them to not take care of problems so much as to teach prevention, to teach about nutrition, and to try to affect health on a more global scale. In 1975, welfare services missionaries that were invented, so to speak, instead of being called health missionaries. And I remember about this time was I graduated from high school in 1976. So that was about the time I graduated from high school. And I remember a little bit about health missionaries. And I remember this vision in my mind of health missionaries as being kind of, I don't know, women who wanted to go on a mission who couldn't do anything else. There was this very negative impression in my mind of what these women were. They weren't as good as the real missionaries who went out and did service missions. And indeed, even in the book, he mentions that even before welfare service missionaries went out, young single men were excluded from consideration primarily because of the nearly concurrent requirement for their service as proselyting missionaries, which was held to be a more spiritually rewarding experience. I thought that was interesting. Anyway, so they started welfare services missionaries in 1975. In 1980, I became a welfare services missionary, and I went, had a special assignment to go work in the refugee camps in Thailand. Initially went to Hong Kong, ended up being called out to go work with 10 other dorky welfare services missionary women, who were the most incredible women I've ever met. And we spent our whole missions working in the refugee camp in Thailand, and later I spent 4 months in the Philippines. During the time we were there, the book describes this as the peak for services missionaries work. And about the time I was at the peak of my mission in 1980-1981, the responsibilities for these missionaries switched from the Welfare Services Department to the Missionary Department. And the entire scope of that operation changed with a renewed focus on proselyting for all of those missionaries. There was, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit after I do the outline about my personal experiences in the system, so I maybe won't spend much more time on it right then. In 1981, they changed the name to Missionaries with Special Assignments, and that's been more the nature, and that includes genealogy and a whole bunch of different missionaries who aren't just proselyting missionaries. He spends very little time just touching base on each one of these developments. But basically there was a shift in emphasis initially from curative kinds of medicine and relief to teaching nutrition and health, and eventually to becoming very nonspecific and generalized because many problems arose out there. One of the primary problems being an image of taking care of our own only. And imagine a needy village in central Mexico where missionaries and resources and everything come in and they take care of the members only in that village. And it was a problem for the church. And I don't mean to criticize any one aspect of this in general. It was a difficult and complex problem that I can't even my insights I can't address in this talk. But there has been a shift. A definite shift. The last part of this chapter, he talks about the Medical Advisory Committee that is in existence now, something different with a purpose where doctors participate. Actually, it's made up probably all the physicians. Are you on that committee? And they actually supervise the health of missionaries and out in the world. And right, I know, but there's like 8 or 10 on that committee. Anyway, I saw their picture once in the Collegium Aesculapium Journal. It spanned 2 pages. Anyway, their job, and it is a wonderful job, is actually to take care of the health of missionaries in the field. And they reduced the morbidity or the disease rate and illness rate 75% in the missionaries in the field. So I think that was a good effort, and that continues to this day. And some doctors are assigned to go out and live in a regional area just to take care of missionaries, especially in places where good medical care is not available. He then talks about humanitarian service in the church and what a boom there is in many programs allowing Mormons to go out and do humanitarian service. He mentions AIUDA, which was a group established in 1968 and is mainly remembered, I don't know very much about this group. He doesn't spend much time, but the Guatemala projects, and I'm sure people remember hearing about the projects done in Guatemala. I remember hearing about them, and they were some of the things that inspired me to want to go on a mission. The Andean Children's Foundation is a wonderful foundation, and I have been on several related trips with them and with an associated group called CHOICE. Anybody familiar with that name, CHOICE? It's the Center for Humanitarian Outreach and Intercultural Exchange, a wonderful group whose sole purpose is to provide a vehicle for volunteers to go out and do humanitarian work. If you want to go, how do you go? There really is no way to go out and do it unless you have some connections. And this group allows you, if you pay your way, they will provide experiences, wonderful third world experiences in Latin America, for any group that wants to go down and give service. They named the BYU Academy of Dentists, the BYU Ezra Taft Cultural and Food Institute, the Collegium Aesculapium, which is a group of doctors, LDS physicians, who have been, at least in the, I remember I was part of that group, the initial founding of this organization, and the goal was to provide a way for doctors in the church to do humanitarian service. I haven't been real excited about all the outcome of that group. It's just hard, and doctors are busy, they don't have time, they can't get away. They have resources, but they're not always available resources. And a lot of the good things that have come out of that group have come, very good projects, have come from a very small handful of doctors who've gone into Mexico. And I've been disappointed with that group, and I'm not involved with them anymore, partly because, hate to say this, but their meetings now are like a combination of priesthood meeting in a medical convention, and neither one is where I want to be at that moment. And, you know, mostly I'm considered one of the wives when I'm there, and it's been very hard for LDS female physicians to fit into that group. And I think their focus has become less service-oriented, although they do provide a listing of opportunities. I've found their meetings to become more and more expensive and in more and more expensive hotels, and I've just been disappointed with where it's gone. And last of all, he mentions the Thrasher Research Fund. The Thrasher Fund is there was a man named, he's a non-Mormon, E.W. Thrasher, goes by Al Thrasher, who donated, he had an endowment of $17 million. I don't remember exactly when it started. Oh, here, it's been administered since 1977. And they have $1 or $2 million a year from that foundation, through which they give money to grants and projects. So people who want to go into third world, specifically for children's nutrition and help of children's health, and they compete for these grants and go out and do it. And I, at least 3 of the women I knew who worked with me in Thailand in the refugee camp have gone and participated in Africa and several other occasions with this. So I know a bit about that. The very end, he talks about the church-wide fast and the capability the church has to raise money. And, you know, more than $10 million were raised that year of the African famine in 2 different fasts. One the church called, and then there was the National Day of Fast, and another third of that money was raised. Some of that money went right away to those projects. Some of it went into a fund to generate money to continue doing those kind of projects, and I'm not sure what has happened with that. And last, he talks about the LDS Humanitarian Services Committee, which is relatively new, and does try to oversee those funds and do other projects to get people involved in humanitarian service. Now I want to just go back for a minute and talk about some personal experiences and critique about, it sounds very good on paper, what he has listed. And I do commend him for coming up with all this. I've never read a place, I've never been able to read in one place all the different things that are being done. And I think many people don't realize that any humanitarian service is being done by the church. So in that way, I think it's very valuable, and he has pieced together a lot of resources. I have to tell you a little anecdote. My nephew recently went on a mission. He was having a hard time deciding to go, and has had more struggles since he went on his mission for several reasons. One is that he was diagnosed with diabetes just before he went, and that was a major life blow for him. He suffered from depression the first time ever in his life, and he was at the peak of this depression when he went in the MTC, and that's the shock of a lifetime anyway. And they put him on Prozac in the MTC, and that shocked him. Just a series of bad things happened to this poor kid, one of the nicest kids I know. And his brother, who's 18, just getting ready to go on his mission, was getting very nervous about the idea of going on a mission because the older one was having so many problems and trying to keep up the fight, but really very close to, he didn't want to come home. He was very depressed, suicidally depressed on his mission. I was the only one that talked to him. I called him as a physician. I'm his aunt. I was the one person in the family who could justify interrupting all the mission routine, and he wasn't being heard. He was trying not to cause a problem. So anyway, his younger brother was worried, and my brother-in-law, the father of these two boys, called the missionary department and said, I have this son who is a wonderful kid. He wants to go and donate time in humanitarian service, but he's not quite comfortable going on a proselyting mission. Is there anything that's offered for him, or could he go and spend 2 years with us sponsoring him with his saved money and go out and do humanitarian service? And there was this pause on the other end, and the man said, well, he could, but it won't count. That's our favorite quote in our family these last few weeks. As these one by one, the young men in my family are having doubts and trying, and they've been so put off by that attitude. And I think that's an example of the attitude in general that has troubled me in the last 10 years as I've participated in humanitarian service. It looks good on paper, but things don't work very well. In the camp in Thailand, the 12 of us worked very hard, and I would say we had the most intense emotional and spiritual experience anyone could possibly have. And we did not do one day of proselyting in that camp. We had a pact with the United Nations, and there was no under-the-table work. We were very straightforward. And in the 18 months that I was involved in that program, both there and in the Philippines, there was continual adversity from the brethren about our program. They didn't send us enough money. They criticized what we were doing. I worked in Philippines in an extension of that mission, and my mission president intimidated me and basically made me go home and get me out of there so that he could take over that program and run it as a proselyting program and get the missionaries into the camp. And I feel like there's this problem of communication among all of us about what we want to do with humanitarian service. It left a very bitter taste in my mouth after, 13, 14 months of working in a dusty refugee camp and having the experience of my life. And I happen to know that at the time, his was the highest baptizing mission in the church at that time. And I happen to know that within 6 or 8 months, if you totaled a number of refugee baptisms in the world, it exceeded any mission in the number of baptisms, and those were people who directly went through our program. Now, whether or not, we will not argue whether that's right or wrong to be baptizing refugees, and I have opinions on that too, but we need to have an open mind about humanitarian service, and it isn't working very well. Except I should say that in the last few years, there are more and more experiences, more and more people are going. They're wonderful, good people who just drop what they're doing and go out and offer Christian service. Yes. Yes. Well, I need to close, and if you want to hear more about it, you can ask some questions about it. But I guess in summary, I think it's a valuable, so there's some valuable information in this book. It's meaty. There's a lot of good resource information. It's not enough for us. We've got to flesh it out, and it just hopefully would get someone else interested a little bit in what we've been doing and what we are going to do as Latter-day Saints.
Well, there are two other people on the panel that I need to introduce. One of them was sort of already referred to, Mary Beth Raines, who was going to do the chapter on sexuality originally. She's home with a bad back and feeling very asexual at the moment, I think. And the other interesting thing about that is that when we looked among us on the four people here, not a one of us had read that chapter. I can't speak for Cindy, but that tells you something about testosterone levels when you reach 50, I guess. The other person I need to introduce very briefly is Lester Bush himself, who is the author of this book, which, as Cindy mentioned, is just one in a series of several books about health and medicine among different religious traditions. The reason that you may not have found a great deal of warmth in this book, although incredible amounts of research, is that Lester Bush, and I'm not sure if he would care if I say this, is the physician to the CIA. And you may know him for another publication, which appeared in a dialogue way back in 1976, which was a masterful treatise, very carefully researched, on the origins of the policy on denial of priesthood to blacks. And it's my own personal feeling that this treatise, plus the problems of the Brazilian temple, were the things that finally were the motivating force behind Spencer Kimball's seeking the Lord's guidance and the resultant revelation in that change in policy. So we have Lester, I think, to give a good deal of thanks for that. Since the time is very short, I think a lot of you have a lot of questions. I think what I would really rather do is dispense with what I had written, other than to give you a 30-second summary of the chapter on madness, which is simply this. When we think about the origins of mental illness, we go all the way back to the earliest ages when mental illness was ascribed to displeasure of the gods or its corollary, demonic possession. And we went from that through the Greeks and their notions of circulating body humors as the cause, then to the pre-scientific age and talking about alignment of the planets, finally to the Romantic era and animal magnetism as a cause. Then along came Freud and told us about the seething cauldron of drives and passions in our unconscious mind that got distorted into mental illness. Then we went from that to the behavioral area of conditioned reflexes, finally to the 50s and the cruel and unusual mothers, back to where we started. And where we started was with demonic possession and circulating body humors. And the rest of the world believes in the circulating body humors in the form of neurotransmitters that carry the messages between the nerve cells in the brain as the cause of mental illness, and the Mormons are back to demonic possession. And with that, how about some questions for the people on the panel? Well, I have one to start with. A policy was recently announced that because of various problems that had occurred in the missionary program, that people would henceforth not be called on missions anymore if they were dependent upon a medicine to keep them healthy. And I'm wondering about panel response to that, and I'm wondering about audience response to that.